The following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
This week's Be a Planner Syndication Mass Show, I am your host, Nathan Ross, Tax CPA, along with my sidekick, Mr. Dan Dubose, CPA today. And hey there, Dan. Good to have you join us again. And for those of you that know from having listened to previous week's shows, we're going to discuss REPs, Real Estate Private Partnership Syndications. We'll tangentially discuss what they are, why you might want to invest in them, how do we assess the math, and today we're going to talk about, at least part of the show, the tax implications of how these creatures work, these private partnerships. I would suggest, and Dan, you can agree or elaborate, that this structure is probably something that most people just getting started will have never experienced in their tax life, correct? The way they work and flow and have limitations, have opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think about that?
What you say is true, I believe. It's a complex investment vehicle, I think, and that does take somebody with some good knowledge to analyze. There's all many moving parts. Some of them many times are the same, but there's different outcomes for different inputs. So who's the best manager out there is one you're trying to find most of the time, or all the time, I guess I should say, to, you know, keep your money invested and keep it rolling for you so that, you know, in that 20% that we're looking for return over that three-year period, so we can double our money every, 3.6 years, I think we've calculated, to get that 20%. We want to
be there. That's our gold standard, 0.04463 per month is the equalizer, or the common delineator, if you will. But I think where I see a lot of confusion on the tax front is, you know, we've got, let's talk about a new investor, someone that's, you know, never been in the real estate private partnership investment class arena. Boy, that's a mouthful. Or even a partnership. And most people do not understand that just because they didn't get any money distributed in the current year, that there won't be a taxable amount that gets reported to them, whether it's positive or negative. And a lot of times I have clients that, you know, they send us K-1s each year, and I know, Dan, you see this as well. And it's got a number on it. They have no clue. They don't really even look at it or understand it. And they just assume, oh, well, I didn't get any cash this year, so that doesn't apply to me. And then they get a real shocker when, especially on a real estate transaction, because, you know, the way a typical real estate project or individual property works is, you know, you have certain attributes such as depreciation, or you might have something like a refinance that occurs where you get a lot of money and no tax or no taxable income, or the reverse can happen. You can sell a property and have significant recapture of depreciation that was taken, and you get a big number on your K-1, and you say, well, wait a minute, I put X in, I got X out, and they're not thinking about the recapture effect on that transaction. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen it as well, Dan, where people are really confused and they don't understand. And you got to kind of walk them back through the history and remind them that, hey, remember all those years that we were getting our operational cash flow, meaning rent over, you know, less expenses equal X, and expenses include depreciation. So on operational cash flow, the depreciation is likely the reason you won't pay tax in these transactions in the interim years. Now, that said, there are exceptions. And I don't know, Dan, the way I feel, if you have taxable income in the interim years without having sold something, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for you. That just means you got in a really good deal, is what that would tell me, if you managed to get a taxable number reported to you over and above depreciation, et cetera. But so when somebody invests in one of these transactions, and let's talk about the newbie. They don't already have any existing transactions that could change what I'm getting ready to tell you because of the way the losses work. But I know I've gotten phone call after phone call from members of Self-Made Millionaires platform where they were told, hey, don't worry about the tax or the penalty on your 401k liquidation, which is what they recommend you do, which is another form of insanity, but we won't go into that. We've talked about it many times on this show and the Saturday Tax Mass show. Let's just say that when you hear somebody say, we recommend you liquidate your 401 so you can get started investing, just ask them two questions. One, why do I have to do that? And if I do it, who's going to give me my money back? Because I don't need to do it, is what I've heard from others. And it'll be interesting to see the reaction. And, of course, they're better salespeople than you are, so be prepared for the comeback. And they're going to make you, to a certain extent, feel like, well, gee, you really don't get it, do you, that we need to take control of our money. And they don't realize, or they do realize. I've had discussions one-on-one with quite a few of the folks there in management about how the 401 trust works, why it achieves exactly what they're telling you to do otherwise. The only difference is we don't stroke a big check to the IRS, and that is a significant difference when it's 30 to 40% of most people's net worth to do that. But so let's assume that you've invested, and let's, for purpose of the illustration, let's assume it's non-retirement money, because I suspect that's what most people end up utilizing as they join these platforms, although most of our clients are doing 401 trust rollovers. But in any event, so you're going to send your $50,000 or your $100,000 or your $300,000, whatever level you plan on investing with, to the syndicator, and they're going to go close a property, multifamily property typically in the case of the platforms we have clients who are members of, and they're going to go perform their magic in terms of any rehab, any value add that they're going to apply. They're going to make an effort to do so that it allows for what to increase, Dan? What's the target here? What are we trying to accomplish by making this property perfect again?
Higher income, higher NOI.
That's right. That's exactly right, which will allow us to do one of two things.
Sell it or refinance it.
That's right. And in most cases, with the projects we work on, it would be a refinance, in which case you're probably looking at maybe by the third year you will have recast or recharacterized the property, NOI, or rents will have gone up, we hope, because of the nice things that we've done to make that property more desirable. And then that gives us the ability to either refinance, in other words, take the current debt off the table, replace it with new debt that has hopefully a higher loan to value. So, you know, maybe we bought the property for, you know, $25 million, we fixed it up, and now we can refinance it and maybe get $30 million out, as an example. That would not be out of the range of possibilities. That would be on the high side. I guess if you did that, you would have enough money to probably almost get your entire investment back, which happens often. Typically, it might be 50 to 60% of the original investment, but in any event, it's a nice number. And then you move forward with the new debt, the new loan. You continue to do things to operate the property at a high level of occupancy. And then eventually, perhaps you undertake a sale. But so let's talk about the tax side of what that timeline represents. And Dan, for someone that doesn't have any real estate, there's no other passive activity, income or losses involved. It's just a very clean scenario. It's the newbie scenario. You're new to this asset space. You invest in your first transaction. And so now you've got that K-1 coming in, you know, March or so of the following year. And so that K-1 is likely going to have, if you invest $100,000, I've seen K-1s, and Dan, I'm sure you can echo this, that might have $80,000 in losses. Why? Well, there's several reasons. Dan, what's the big one these days? What does almost every syndicator propose to do? And you get excited because you think it's going to knock down your taxes on your W-2 you're getting from the big company.
Are you talking about depreciation?
I'm talking about depreciation on steroids. What would we call that in year one?
Cost segregation,
bonus, there you go, bonus depreciation, et cetera. And that's how we generate $80,000 or whatever the number is on a $100,000 investment. I've seen some, I was looking at one the other day, I didn't dig into it too far. I just assumed that the CPAs that helped put the deal together had found a way, but I think you put $100,000 in and had a $102,000 first year loss. I guess that could happen with the leverage, but I'm trying to think, well, I don't know. I'm trying to think, does that mean it's a low leverage or a high leverage? May mean it's, well, I don't know. I'm with you. I thought it'd be a high leverage. It's just these days you're not seeing many high leverage deals, although we have looked at a couple lately that were 75%, and I think one that may have been 80, but it was unusual. But so anyway, so let's, regardless of what that loss is, let's say it's 80, just for sake of illustration. So then, Dan, what happens when you give that K-1 to your tax preparer, and if they know what they're doing, they enter that correctly in their tax software, how much of that loss, again, no other passive income is there, how much of that loss is going to flow through to that year's personal 1040 Schedule E, page 2, for that new real estate investor?
Probably zero.
Right. And so where does it go? Does it just, do we not get it because we don't have other passive income? What happens in that case, Dan? How do we keep up with it?
We hear talk a lot lately about cloud-based this or cloud-based that. Well, listen, kind of out in the clouds until such time as you get out of that investment.
Not to be confused with the tech cloud, but basically what Dan is saying, you'll see a new form in your return if you are new to the real estate investment arena. What form number might that be, Dan?
8582, I think it is.
That's right. The 8582 form is what tracks our passive activity loss limitation. And so it's not that we don't get to claim the deduction. It's deferred. We get to hang on to it, get to carry it forward, add to it, take away from it as we have other qualifying passive losses, which means you would have had some qualifying income. And, you know, you get to utilize the loss at that time. So it's not lost. It's just deferred. However, for those of you that may be using retirement money, and you, or it was retirement money, but due to the amateur tax advice that you were given, you liquidated those funds and at least paid the tax. And if you're under 59 and a half, or you haven't separated from your job or you didn't use a postnuptial agreement, which we will talk about on another show. We have before, by the way, if you could go back into the archives and find it. You know, if you don't have those scenarios, you're going to pay the 10% penalty in addition to the tax. And so, you know, if you've liquidated $500,000, as an example, you're going to owe a bunch of money, is the bottom line. And no, you do not get the losses to offset the tax that's due that next April. Nor would they ever, if you could get the losses, would it offset the 10% premature distribution penalty for those that are under 59 and a half and don't qualify with one of the aforementioned exceptions. And before everybody gets excited about that postnup agreement, that only works if you're married and you live in the great state of Texas, which, you know, I'm sure is most of the listeners on this show. However, you don't want to wait. It's not like you can wait and do that after you've liquidated your funds. You got to get out ahead of it. We assist with that. We've got an attorney lined up that'll do that for you. And it may come as a surprise to you that you don't have to quit your job or turn 59 and a half. And I would suggest if you call your HR department and ask them, hey, how do I get my money out of my 401? I heard on the radio that I can do that, they're not going to give you the answer that you're looking for. They typically don't even know that it's possible. So if you're looking to do that, or if you would otherwise like to work with us, consider going to our website, baplanner.com. That's baplanner.com, and fill out the intake forms there at the top of our website on the right. And schedule a call, which is also the link for that's right there. So link to intake forms, link to schedule a call, both top right of the baplanner.com website. That's baplanner.com. And we'll explain to you how that works. And it is, you know, again, it's a godsend for most American families that have all their wealth, you know, built up in their retirement account. By the way, I was wanting to mention that if you do want to get a question into us today, feel free to either send us an email to info@npross.com or send us a text to area 713-581-0195, and if it's something that's germane to today's topic, we'll be happy to address it live here on the air, or we will punt until after the show, and we will respond to you. So in any event, so now, Dan, we've gotten that first year K-1, we've you know, inputted the data into a tax software that will give us a new form, 8582. We've got the loss cordoned off, if you will. It's going to be there for posterity's sake, as long as we file using the data that rolls over each year, right? I you know, oftentimes see people that either change CPAs or maybe they changed their TurboTax software, didn't pull the data through, however that happens, whether it's local or if it's cloud-based, it's probably going to come through. But you want to make real sure every year you get that return back from your accountant that that 8582 is in there and it's been updated for the current year. It's not just the current year, but it reflects the cumulative. Because what's going to happen, Dan, and the glorious day that you sell that transaction at a big gain, what happens?
Well, there'll be a big loss recognized for the carry forwards of all these 3 or 4, 5, 6 years, whatever it might be, that you've owned that property. That may
right.
offset,
and,
help offset
and what,
that big gain.
Yeah, and what if you had the next year invested in another transaction and maybe the fourth year invested in two more? And so now we're tracking four loss limitations each year. And so when you sell one of those, or maybe two of them, are the losses fungible? Can I use, in other words, can I use all of the loss that I've tracked on all four deals against the gains on any two of them? Or does it have to be just the loss that's attributable to those two that sold? How does that work?
To the loss is carried by property, recognized finally by property. So as you buy more, you just carry forward those new numbers. The new losses.
Okay, but yeah, I don't think you're catching what I was trying to determine or try to help explain. The losses don't matter from whence they came, correct? It's simply that they're passive losses being applied to passive income in the current year.
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So when people say, "Well, you know, I've got a." 80,000, or let's use a different number. Let's say I've got a $120,000 gain. That would be nice, right? But I only invested $100. Does that mean they've got a $20,000 taxable reportable gain? Not necessarily. Depends on, well, they've got that much gain, but they may have $180 built up in losses, right? Loss carry forwards. So that they essentially would pay no tax in the year of disposition / gain recognition. But what does that do, Dan? That reduces the carry forward, correct? At that point?
Yes.
And so when we sell the next transaction, do we possibly have a problem in that we've already used certain amounts of carry forward losses that now we're down to a smaller number? That's carrying forward?
You'll have some income to be recognized.
You might, unless you did what?
Invest.
You saw it coming. That's right. You saw it coming. The lead partner you're dealing with said, hey, we're entertaining some offers. We think we're going to have a sale. That'll be probably 6 months or a year out. And that's when you start looking for another transaction, because the only bad thing that can result from this, these are good problems to have, wouldn't you say, Dan? I like these problems, right?
Yeah.
And the only bad problem would be if you didn't get the gain distributed out to you, whatever that number is, in time to buy another transaction before the end of the year. I mean, that would be tragic if you got the gain distributed finally on December 30th or 31st, or probably even earlier than that, in which case you would have the funds to pull the trigger on another transaction. I mean, normally you can't just pop up and say, oh, I got $100,000 to invest here. Can I get in today if it's a deal that's already underway? I mean, they probably will have already filled the roster. Maybe not. It's possible. I mean, we see some short time lines on that scenario. But bottom line is, that's how you play the game. You generate, you invest, you generate losses, you generate gains, and hopefully, simultaneously, you can generate more losses if you don't have enough to carry forward and offset that gain. And let me ask you something else, Dan. In a normal multifamily transaction and other real estate, we're going to get distributions over the life of that transaction. We've already talked about operational cash flow, refinance cash flow, and then cash flow on exit. And those types of cash flow typically generate different tax outcomes, correct? And what would you expect the tax effect to be on operational cash flows and on refinances? What do we normally see? There are some exceptions, but normally. Is it taxable? Is cash flow ever taxable, by the way? What's taxable? Cash flow or gains and losses, i.e. recognition of taxable income? What creates tax?
Recognition of capital income or recognition of taxable income is certainly taxable. The cash flow may or may not be. If you've got a taxable cash flow, or if you've got a property that is cash flowing and you're paying tax, you really got a sweet deal, I would think.
Yeah, that's like a gusher if it were an oil well, right?
That's right.
but in any event, what about refinances, Dan? I hear people, I don't know that I've ever seen a discussion of a refinance where they say it's not taxable. And you and I both know there can be situations, depending on one's basis in an activity, where it does become taxable, correct?
You know, if you get your basis, you've used up your basis possibly to the extent that you've had deductions, whether they're taxable or not, you could have some taxable income.
Well, that's right. And if you did, what would the character of that income be on a real estate transaction like these?
It'd be capital income.
Right, capital gain income. And it's assumed by the IRS that were you to end up in that situation, that you've sold part of your interest if you get more than what your cost basis is. And we're going to save cost basis discussion, definitions, et cetera, for another show. But suffice it to say, it's rare in this asset space, but it has happened, and it's a real shocker when you realize it. Of course, it's also, I guess, one of those things where it's good news, bad news, right, Dan, that you could pull that off. It's kind of like being taxed on your operational cash flow. It's like, you know, I really don't have a whole lot of sympathy for someone that complains about paying tax on a multifamily transaction. And I'm talking about even after all the deductions have been considered, including depreciation. Of course, depreciation is, you know, an interesting concept. There's several things about it that I find it's, you know, you wonder who was the Einstein that thought these concepts up at time, right, Dan? I know we say that on multiple tax fronts. But, you know, let's talk about a rental property of single family, because most multifamily projects, you're going to be dealing with a level of sophistication on the tax reporting by whoever the sponsor or lead partner has prepared the returns. But take a single family, and I see this all the time. I'll have a prospect call us, want to talk about us taking on their tax preparation business, which Dan loves to do. So, you know, I'm going to tell you, yes, call us for that. We're going to make sure Dan stays busy doing that. I'd like to avoid that stuff. But anyway, bottom line is, how many times, Dan, have we seen a return? Usually it's a return that somebody did on TurboTax, although I'm amazed. I've seen others. I don't know that I've seen CPA-type reporting, although it's probably happened. But typically this would be like a Liberty Tax or an H&R Block level preparer, where I look at the Schedule E, and I'm trying to figure out how many assets are involved for depreciation purposes, and I see no depreciation, no cumulative, no current year. Have you seen some of those, Dan? Do you recall some of those?
Yes, we have seen them, and it's shocking when you do. But it's, you know, nowadays if things are done with a computer, it's hard. I mean, you just got to be really dumb to miss that. But it does happen.
Well, careless would probably be a kinder word. Or you see depreciation, you see a $80,000 acquisition. I guess I'm thinking back to yesteryear. There's not many of those today on a 322 single story, you know, the bread and butter real estate or single family asset for rental property. But you'll see it where, you know, if you looked at the HUD that accompanied it, it showed an $80,000 purchase price. Then you'll look at the depreciation schedule to see $80,000 in dwelling, and that's when you realize, okay, whoever did this return doesn't do this a lot, because they did not allocate, you know, I don't know what, Dan, 10 to 20, 25%, maybe 30, depending on the property, where it's located, to the land value. And that's something that has to be allocated. You can't depreciate land. But in any event, on the ones that have no depreciation, what's the rule on, let's say you sell that property later. Let's say you bought it for 80, you sell it for 100, how much gain do you have on that? Taxable reportable gain. Just ballpark, Dan. I know we don't have a calculator in our brain, but most lay people are going to say, hey, I got a $20,000 gain. What's the reality, Dan, after, let's say, 5 years on a, let's make it a $90,000 property so we can do some easy math. Let's just say we're getting a 30-year life, even though it's 27 and a half. It'll make that calculation. Let's just say the depreciable value, the dwelling value, is 90. We sell it for 100, and the layperson says, hey, I've got a $10,000 gain. What's the reality of how much that gain really is, Dan, on 5 years? So $3,000 a year.
$25,000 gain.
Correct. And how we get there is we've got how much a year in depreciation? 3,000 times 5 years. So our accumulated depreciation is 15. That means our adjusted basis off of a $90,000 depreciable amount is how much at that point, Dan?
$75,000.
That's right. And then we sold it for $100, and that's how Dan got to the $25,000 gain. And Dan, how much of that gain is taxed at, and I know I'm kind of melding some rules together here, but let's live in the world of cost segregation and bonus depreciation. How much of that gain, or let's say this, is the entire $25,000 gain capital? I don't have the ability to break that down in my head, but I'm
no,
curious.
No, only $15,000 would be capital. $10,000 would be a capital gain. $15,000 would be the ordinary gain. You recapture that depreciation, bring it back to the $90,000.
Yeah, well, some of it would still, you're going to recapture as much of the ordinary component. There would still be, I think, some depreciation allocable to the dwelling that would be stay in the 1250 class. But bottom line is, but if you didn't take the depreciation, surely you don't pay tax on recapture, Dan. That's not fair. Is that how the rule works? Or
no,
does fair matter?
Whether you take the depreciation or not, you will have recognized income. And it would, it's going to total up to $25,000.
Yeah, and what's that term? I've forgotten. It's something about depreciation allowable or as allowable,
allowable,
I think is the key.
Yes, exactly right.
As allowable.
Or allowed.
So this would be akin to someone that likes to overpay their taxes every year and thinks they're hitting a grand slam when they get a big refund back, right? Where, you know, you're given,
yeah.
Right. So if you say, well, I don't need that depreciation, or I don't want to be bothered with having to understand how those rules work, and that's probably, you know, some of the folks that do it. Others just don't even know. I mean, even though TurboTax is kind of, you know, hitting you over the head as you go through filling out its screens. The problem is it's like Nathan going to Home Depot and buying that Makita circular saw. I'm more likely to cut my leg off than to end up with a nice doghouse, right? Or whatever I'm doing. And same thing with your tax software. If you don't understand the perspective of how these rules work, it's hard to get there. Because you're going to get all the questions. TurboTax is going to do its best to alert you and say, hey, pay attention here. This is your choice. But you don't have a background or a knowledge base to understand the perspective, let's say, of that. And so, believe it or not, when you forego depreciation, it's just kind of lurking below the surface. Your basis is still going to be $75,000, even though you didn't claim it, and you're still going to get to pay a gain. And so that's why when you come to CPAs like Dan and myself, we will catch up the depreciation. There's some things that we can do that you know, on your behalf to get the benefit retroactively, by the way, of that depreciation. And so we don't like seeing people pay tax. I guess I could say twice. I don't really suppose it's really twice, though, is it? Dan, it's once, but
well,
feels like it.
You're giving the government a tax-free or an interest-free loan for however long you have it.
Well, it's very similar to what I say about, you know, people that overpay that think, you know, they did good this year. Whereas I tell people, hey, Our goal is for you to owe $10 million come next April. You'll know about it. You will know if you had put $30 million in your bank account, right, Dan, during the year. And the goal is for you to owe $10 million and not have a penalty. Isn't that a beautiful thing, Dan, when that can happen? And it may not be $10
million. I've done one tax return in my life, and it was somebody that, you know, it wasn't a big amount of money that they had taxed, but the tax paid in, the tax due was zero. And I've been doing this for, 40, 50 years, and I've had one. I called it the perfect one. It happened to be from my mother, actually. It was kind of amazing to me.
It ended at zero without any manipulation on your part as to what you claimed.
Exactly. Claim. That's no manipulation. Well, it was zero the first time through. Zero.
Well, that is, I can't say that I've ever had that happen. I've gotten to zero because, you know, we woke up and realized, oh, they forgot to claim something, and, you know, it kind of got us there. But anyway, okay, so that's our quick discussion on how the first-year losses work, and ensuing years for that matter. And so as a newbie, your challenge is going to be playing that game of gain year versus loss year. How do we marry them up to avoid paying tax? Because it is absolutely possible and legally permissible, just like Donald Trump has done many times. There is nothing sordid. There is nothing about not being patriotic. There is no reason other than I would suggest, I don't want to say stupidity. Let's just say
ignorance.
Lack of familiarity or lack of understanding the rules that should prevent you from claiming the deductions. I get a kick out of the media, both with Trump, and I remember his son-in-law, Jared, had somehow the press had gotten a hold of some of his returns, I believe, and they were acting like he was a criminal because he used that thing called, it's called something like depreciation. You could tell the media was very uncomfortable with the concept that someone that spends hundreds of millions of dollars, in their case, on real estate might get to recover their costs vis-a-vis the rules that Congress put in place a long time ago. And all of a sudden, just because it's the MAGA crowd, it should be thought of as unpatriotic, when even our own current sitting president has used, God forbid, an S-Corp, I think was the discussion at one point, and managed to take advantage of significant tax law preferences, right? And all I can say is, if Congress didn't intend for us to take advantage of them, they can change them at any point in time. They can get a majority and have a president agree to sign it. Correct, Dan?
That's right. That's the way the process works.
Well, that's right. That's kind of like the student loan forgiveness, you know, although that's a little different because you didn't have to get a majority in Congress. They still may. I'm not so sure that's going to fly once it gets reviewed by the Supreme Court, because they did that under the guise of an emergency authorization, even right at the time they were saying the emergency, i.e. the pandemic, was no more. It's been solved. We've solved the whole pandemic thing. So if that's the case, how were you able to execute a student loan forgiveness predicated on that? That's going to be something you'll see discussed more than a little bit as the prospective lawsuits work their way through to the courts or through the courts. Dan, let's talk about since we kind of went a little bit further than we thought on the cash flow versus tax scenario or taxable income. Let's talk about a transaction. I want to talk about one that I don't think you were ready, but I'm still going to do it because the metrics are too good. And I want to say that this deal, this offering has closed, but it's a project here in Houston. I'm not going to mention names. It is a 506C. I guess the reason I want to discuss this one is because I want to convey that there are transactions, even in the day of higher interest rates and lower LTVs, loan to values, where money or returns are being targeted that are, in my to my way of thinking, just like we were looking for a year ago. And I mean, they've got equity multiples that generate 0.05 and higher per month. And they've got IRRs in, you know, the high to mid 20s. And let me see if I can find where this, let's see. Okay, so it's in the energy corridor. It's minimum investment. This is out on CrowdStreet, by the way, crowdstreet.com, which if you're accredited, meaning you've got at least $1 million net worth or you've earned at least $200,000 per year for 3 years, if you're single and you expect to continue at that level, 200 or higher, or if you're married filing joint, 300,000. So this transaction, and I can see it's almost like watching the process unfold right before your eyes. It's kind of like a train wreck that nobody gets hurt in, if that's possible. And, you know, the promote, listen to the structure, Dan. This is telling that we're seeing syndicators take a softer line on the way they structure their promotes and fees. There's a hurdle rate on the waterfall of 10%. And so until the returns are up to 10%, the promote is zero. And this is cumulative compounding 10%. Okay. So the promoter gets zero. Thereafter, it's an 80-20 split. That's pretty notable compared to a year ago, right? This is pretty righteous.
6 months ago.
Well, that's right. That's right. Or even now, on the way some of these guys think. And anyway, so to continue on, this is fairly new construction, I believe. Let me look here. Well, I don't see it. It has to be based on the images, but it's not brand new. I'm going to say it's within the last 5 to 10 years. But in any event, you know, the group that's taken this on they currently manage approximately 2,500 units in the Houston area, and they're operating at a 95% portfolio-wide occupancy rate. Pretty stout, wouldn't you say, Dan?
I'd say that's very good.
Yeah, and so their approach has been to basically do what the fast food giants do. That's what they say in their business plan here, which is create a product that is consistent and easy to replicate, acquire materials in bulk from reliable suppliers, and obtain labor efficiencies from a repeated process. During the renovation period, management focuses on increasing rents on units that are currently priced below the median rent for a given floor plan. If the tenant declines the higher rent, then they'll renovate and market that apartment. They won't renew, in other words. They'll renovate, market the apartment at a renovated price. And that's what's leading from the tenant side. If you listen to the show yesterday, we talked about the impact of those 10 to 15% rent increases that are still out there in the multifamily market. It's not like the rents are going down just because there's been some static with inflation and potential recession. That doesn't appear to be affecting the Houston apartment owner just yet. But in any event, this transaction also got an interest rate cap. They paid down essentially for the entire three-year projected hold that would see a maximum maximum. This isn't what they're going to be at the outset, but it's a maximum of 7%. So this is the second transaction that we're seeing that mentions 7%. The other one, which I believe was the project up in outside Chicago, had a 7. I believe it was 7.2%. Rate. So we're going to see more and more of that, and I have a feeling we're going to fast forward 2 or 3 months and feel lucky to see transactions with 7%. But in any event, let's see. They had the hypothetical. Believe we had the hypothetical $100,000 investor. Let me find that here. Yeah, here we go. So on a 3-year, the initial, well, this is actually the partnership in total, but it's still, well, no, the breakdown by the individual investor on $100,000, it's $183,000 out after the sell. And so that's a how much is that, Dan? EMX? 1.83, correct?
Yes.
So if we divide that into 36, let's see, it worked out to 0.051. So that's, 25% higher than we would typically be looking for. So not bad.
Deal.
I mean, really good, actually. I shouldn't say not bad. That's really good. If they hit that, I mean, that's a target. Understand, target doesn't mean they're guaranteeing it. And let me see timing-wise. That's the next thing we want to look at is, okay, we like the equity multiple. Over time, it generates, let's see, actually it's 100. Well, no, it's 183. I think that's the number I said. That includes all the project cash flows. That includes, well, in this case, they look at selling in year 3, so there would not be a refinance. And that's a targeted average cash return. So, you know, the first year, it's 0 cash flow projected. Second year is 5,000 on 100, so that's 5%. Third year, it jumps up to 16. So it's kind of backloaded, in the sense that, you know, if you're doing this for near-term cash flow, might not be one that you care to invest in. We saw a deal last week that had a 5-year hold and had 0 cash flow until the exit. But, boy, was it a whopper. It was a almost 4.0 equity multiple in 5 years. That's a lot higher than what we suggest is the gold standard of 2.0 after 3.6 years. So theoretically, 4 would be after 7.2. Well, they were getting there in 5, or at least that was the plan. And they've done it before, by the way. This group that I'm referring to has been to the finish line many times before with different commercial real estate asset types. But in this case, the IRR, which is a little bit misleading, although I would argue in this case it's pretty real. It's 22.7. When you're giving the bulk of the cash on the back end, of course, 3 years isn't a long back end, and you still achieve a 22.7% internal rate of return, that's a pretty rich deal. I mean, normally to get to that level, you'd have to be cranking out the cash flow early on, right? Because the IRR will be higher to the extent you're getting your money back quicker, because it gives you the ability to put it into other cash flow producing assets. But in any event, the targeted equity multiple of 1.8x is pretty rich on a 3-year deal. And at the project level, it's a bit higher even. It's a 25% IRR, internal rate of return, with a 2.0 equity multiple. And so, you know, the other participants in the project, i.e. the team, is getting a nice return on their interest as well. And I would say that while the three-year hold is the plan, the debt that they've undertaken, by the way, it's a $57 million loan, Dan, and I don't have the LTV in front of me. But in any event, it's a five-year possible debt term. So three-year, I'm assuming, plus a 2 1-year extensions. Oh, yeah, that is what it is. So the term's 3 years, 2 12-month extension option periods, 25-year amortization and non-recourse, which is, you know, for a project of this nature, pretty standard. In any event, let's look at the fees real quick. We just got a minute left here. Acquisition fee is 1%. Not bad. Asset management fee is 2%. Got a debt arranger fee. We don't like that. It's half of 1% of the proceeds. Got a 5% construction management fee. There's a guarantee fee of $200,000. We don't like to see that. We think that's what you get promotes for. I'm assuming it's the sponsors. A financial advisory fee, whatever that is, it's probably an affiliate, $142,000. Don't like to see that, but property management's normal, 3%. Well, I know that was a quick overview, but this one stood out. It's the only reason I brought it up, but we are at the end of the show. As Rod Stewart's famous for saying, the part you've all been waiting for. And so we do enjoy having Dan on once again. Dan, thank you for attending.
Thank you, Nathan.
And we'll be back this coming Saturday with more of the Be a Planner Tax Mash show. We hope that you can tune in once again. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in next Saturday at 5 for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEV.